Where were you born? Now, in the church, we're used to hearing various questions at various times, and certainly one of the questions that many of us have heard in the past is, why were you born? And the church has done a good job over the years of asking pertinent questions that people wonder about and then providing answers based upon the Bible. So we know of questions such as, why were you born? And of course, many of us have probably heard, as almost every minister I know has used the question at some point or another, why are we here? We used to hear that almost every year at the Feast of Tabernacles or various holy days. Why are we here? And of course, why are we born? And if we understand why we're born, we certainly have a great understanding into God's plan. And even that was started from before the foundation of the earth. But my question for you today is, where were you born? And just out of curiosity, how many of you were born outside of the state of Pennsylvania? So a couple. Sugar, are you from Wisconsin too? I was born outside of Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, for that matter. So how many of you were born in the same county in which you live now? Yeah, there's a few people that are still that local. But let me ask one more question. How many of you chose the place where you were born? I'm not talking about the hospital, but the state or the country or whatever it might be, however we want to word it. How many of us got to choose where we were born? Well, we know we don't get to choose where we are born. But we do know or should understand this. I certainly have grown to understand that there is no place like home. And there's many ways to look at that. I very much enjoy being at home with my family in our house where we live, but there's no place like the USA. When I was a young kid, this is a time in my life that I don't remember. I don't know exactly when it was, but somewhere around 3 to 6 months old, my family moved into a house. So my mother had convinced my father, because of 1975 and prophecy, that he wouldn't have to make too many payments on this house. So they moved out of an apartment and bought a house. And so somewhere between 3 and 6 months old, I moved into this house, and I stayed in that same house, usually in the same bedroom, for 20 years. I didn't go off to college until I was 20 years old. And I had traveled some, primarily, though, for the Feast of Tabernacles. So for the feast, we had gone to various states just within the United States. But where we lived in Kentucky, south of Louisville, was the path for the airplanes coming into Stanford Field, which is what they now call an international airport there in Louisville, Kentucky. So I used to sit in my front yard and watch these planes as they descend or as they take off, and some of them would go up and bank, and we can see that even now sometimes from, I don't know if they're from Dulles or Reagan or where they're coming from, but they come towards our house and then they'll bank even where we are now. But I used to wonder, where are those people coming from and where are those people going? And I couldn't wait to travel. And the first time I went out of the country, I was a junior in college. And at the time, of course, with Ambassador College, they had the opportunities to teach English in various parts of the world with Ambassador Foundation. So I was selected to go and teach English in Sri Lanka, a third world country. It was very much a developing country back in the 80s. And so we landed in Thailand and spent a couple of weeks in Thailand. And then went to Sri Lanka and lived there for a year in various parts of the country, two different parts of the country to teach. So it was very educational for me. But one of the first things I started to notice is that not everybody is American and not everybody lives as Americans. But I definitely caught the travel bug. And since then, I've been to I don't have a goal on how many countries. I used to think I'd like to go to every continent. And so when we're talking about transferring for the feast sometime to Argentina, and I'm trying to get my wife to go all the way down to South America, because you could take I think it's about an hour and a half flight into Antarctica, and they'll stamp your passport. You got to pay your visa and stuff, and then you can say you've been to that continent if you're trying to get to all the continents. I don't know if we'll ever do that. According to her, we won't. But I mean, I really got the travel bug and have very much enjoyed traveling and seeing different cultures and how various people live. But I have certainly learned that there is no place like home. There is no place like America. As much as I enjoy traveling, and if I don't go somewhere, Valerie, we've talked about this, she'll feel the same way, that if we don't go on a trip every so often, we just start to feel like, well, it's time to travel. We got to go somewhere and do something. And so we both very much enjoy traveling internationally. But we know there is no place like home. And we certainly understand that the majority of human beings do not live as we live in America. There are other prosperous nations and other prosperous countries. We can recognize that. But the majority of people don't live like we live. The majority of people throughout the world don't have the things that we are able to have simply because we were born, or as the case may be for some, I don't know of anyone in this room, but some people who have immigrated and have become citizens and now live in this country. But what have you, another question, what have you or what have I done to deserve the blessings that we have in this great country? In this country of America. Now, I can tell you that people that I've met around the world still, even though there's a certain, in my lifetime, I've seen a certain hatred for the West and for America and various countries, but as we travel, people still want to come to America. When we go to Kenya, I've teased about this. I try not to bring it up, but just with my personality, I like to have fun with people. But there's a young man there. I think I first met him when he was 16, and he was at the camp when I was working there. And he's 24 now, and he has his own family, and he has twins. One of them is named Fidel Castro, and one of them is named, let me see if it'll come to me. It's not coming to me. But anyway, he's got twins. And so I tease with him, saying, look, he's got another son as well. And I said, look, God has only blessed me with daughters, so you should give me one of your sons. You know, you have three. You had two at one time. And he, what shocked me about it, well, I was just trying to tease with him, was he was like, okay, pick one. Now, maybe he was teasing back, but I think if I were to say, you know, if we could work this out, I'd like one of your sons to come to America and live with us and grow up in America, he would be okay with it. He'd say, okay, pick, that's what he told me, pick one. Because they recognize the blessings that we have. They automatically think everyone from the West is wealthy and rich. And if you talk about, you don't need to raise your hands or anything, but how many of you own a house or pay in the bank, as I like to say, for a house? Maybe you've got it paid off. How many of you have a vehicle? You have a car. How many of you have more than one vehicle? DJ, you're not looking too too enthused right now, but you know, if you have a house and you have a car and you eat on a regular basis, you know, for to have a refrigerator, how many of you expect your electricity to work more than 12 hours a day? So just some of the very basic things that we have, they look at and think you are wealthy. And so we have learned over the years that because they think we have so much, they get it in their head that we can just give them things. So they'll come up to us and ask for a cell phone or ask for our camera or ask for our clothes or whatever it might be, because they think, well, surely you can just get more. Just get another camera. Give me your camera and then you could get another camera. At the feast this year, let's turn to Revelation chapter 2. I read this verse to them just to point out that God is not surprised that some areas of the world have more than other areas. And in Revelation chapter 2, we know the verses in chapters 2 and 3 where it's talking to the churches that are along the mail route, the seven churches. In verse 8 it says, "And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things says the first and the last, who was dead and came to life. I know your works, tribulation and poverty." Now it says, "But you are rich," in parentheses, and that's referring to spiritually. It says, "And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan." So God knows that some people are in poverty or some people have less. One of the principles that I strive to teach there and here, for that matter, is that godliness with contentment is great gain. But they have this idea that if you have, you should just give it to them and then go get more or just whatever the case might be. So I made the point that God certainly knows their poverty. And God understands that they might have less than others. But you know, we have these wonderful blessings of living here in America, whether we've been born here, whether we've immigrated here, whatever it might be. We live in America, and what have we done to deserve it? We understand, as I made the point, none of us chose to be born here. And so once somebody asked me if I feel guilty about coming back to America after being in third world countries, and I did not hesitate at all. No, I feel blessed, and I give thanks to God for what we've been blessed with and what we have in this country. Because we should recognize and understand that it comes from God. And today, for the rest of the sermon time, I want to review the promises made to Abraham. Just because it's come up a couple of times in conversations recently, I just want to go through the promises that were made to Abraham. Now, these were promises that were guaranteed by God. And we're going to go through the various times in Genesis where God promised to Abraham. And so he made a promise more than once, and then later he said it was going to be a covenant. So once he reached this covenant with Abraham, it became a formal agreement. And then he said it's going to be a covenant forever between God and Abraham and Abraham's descendants. In the past, we used to call it, or we used to say quite often, these were promises of race and grace. Now, I don't hear that in the church as often as we used to, put in those terms, promises of race and grace. And the church hasn't come out with anything officially. Mr. Franks, when he teaches the class on fundamental beliefs, and this is the fundamental belief of the Church of God, that God made promises to Abraham. But he brings it out that there have been people over time that have twisted the scriptures and used this promise to Abraham to show that they are the superior peoples. So they use this and they call it the promise of race that was given to Abraham and Abraham's descendants to show that they are superior to anyone else. And so it seems as if we've gotten away a little bit of using the promise of race. We certainly use the promise of grace in that sense, but it doesn't take away from the promises that were made to Abraham and his descendants. And so let me explain what I mean by that. Just because people twist scriptures doesn't make it untrue. So because people twist the scriptures about the Sabbath, what do you hear about the Sabbath? Well, first of all, the Sabbath is Sunday. Or it might be the Sabbath is in your heart. Anytime you keep it holy before God, that's okay. People have all kinds of ideas about the holy time that God has set apart for worship. But just because people twist the scriptures about the Sabbath, it doesn't lessen the Sabbath. It doesn't take away from the truth about the Sabbath. So I bring that out just because people have twisted the scriptures to make them say what they want. And there's that proclivity in human nature, for whatever be the reason, that we always tend to want to exalt ourselves for one reason or another. When I say we, I'm talking about human beings and human nature. So we always find a reason. You know, men think they're better than women. Women think they're better than men. This color thinks they're better than that color. Tall people think they're better than taller people. I don't want to make any comments about short people while I'm standing up here. Don't want to talk about Mr. Godfrey today or myself. So We recognize that there's a proclivity in human beings to somehow find a reason as to why we think we are better than others. So some people have taken these promises to Abraham and twisted them to say we are the superior race. Doesn't mean that in any way, shape, or form. We understand that God created human beings with the same potential. We should understand that God created human beings with the same blood. Let's look at Acts chapter 17. You'll remember the section of Scripture where Paul is in Athens and he's addressing the Areopagus. And he tells them that he perceives in all things that they're very religious. In verse 24, it says, God who made the world, so this is Acts 17, verse 24, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heavens and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. And so we see that God has made human beings from one blood, from the same blood. All human beings have blood. All human beings are created equal and have the same opportunity to be in God's family. But there is a promise that is made to Abraham and to Abraham's descendants, guaranteed by God. This is a guaranteed covenant by God, and God cannot lie. We know that from Scripture, that God cannot lie. So let's, first of all, understand that these promises came about because of Abraham, the father of the faithful. He had a heart that was willing to obey God. He had a heart that God was able to work with. In Romans chapter 4, we could read this whole chapter about Abraham. In verse 1, it says, what then shall we say that Abraham our father has found according to the flesh? Verse 2, for if Abraham was justified by works, he has something of which to boast, but not before God. For what does the Scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. So we see that Abraham believed God, and this is repeated over and over in Scripture. It's in Galatians, it's in the book of James. Abraham is known as the father of the faithful. So when we put the Scriptures together, we should understand that Abraham heard God, and he believed God, and he was faithful to strive to do what God asked him to. And so by the time he asked him to leave his land of Ur, from what we understand, it's not like he was a young man ready to go out west or somewhere and make his own fortune. Abraham, by that time, had already been established to some degree, and we believe he was already a wealthy individual by the time he was told to leave the land of Ur. So when God said, hey, pack up your things and leave, he did what God asked him to do. So we see that Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. And James, of course, uses Abraham as the example of faith, as the example of someone who demonstrates their belief in God by their faith, by their works, by their obedience. And so because of Abraham's belief, Abraham's faithfulness, Abraham's obedience. God made certain promises to him. So he made these promises to Abraham and to Abraham's descendants. So we recognize the promises to his descendants, promises of nationality or preeminence as a peoples, and also then, of course, the spiritual aspect, the promise of grace through Jesus Christ. So it's important that we understand these promises so that we can understand some about prophecy, and we can understand what God is doing and why God is doing certain things the way that he's doing them. So we have the blessings of the physical blessings to a specific people, and we understand it's not because they're greater, smaller, taller, whatever it might be. It's because of Abraham. They are the descendants of Abraham. So God has blessed them in that way. And then there's the spiritual blessings, the greater blessings that are open to all of humanity. So the blessing or the promise of grace is a promise that is open to all humanity, each in their own time. And as we go through the scriptures, we'll understand that that blessing, the spiritual blessing, is because of Jesus Christ coming down through the descendants of Abraham. So we see that throughout the book of Genesis, it is mentioned, I should say, seven times, this promise or these promises and the covenant with Abraham. So let's look at these in Genesis chapter 12. So God committed to these promises. And we see in Genesis chapter 12, this is what I alluded to or talked a little bit about earlier as far as when God told him to get out of his country. In verse 1, Genesis 12 verse 1, it says, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you." Now, it's in America, we're used to city dwellers. If you look at the population centers in the U.S., you're looking at big cities. The population centers are not rural Pennsylvania or middle America. We tend to be city dwellers. But I've learned this, even though I grew up in a rural area in Kentucky, I've learned this more after being in Kenya, is that land that's passed down from generation to generation is very important to them. And a lot of them, they only have land because it was passed down through generations. So the point that I'm making by bringing that out is that Abraham was leaving what he understood to some degree. I don't know that he was the firstborn, but he would have inherited his father's land. He's told to get out of his father's house to a different land, to a land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now that's all the families of the earth shall be blessed. We have no doubt that that is because of Jesus Christ coming down through the line of Judah. And every human being in their time will have the opportunity for salvation. But we can also recognize that through the descendants of Abraham, the world has been blessed. Have you ever wondered when you watch the news and you hear about the fact that we have a financial crisis in our country to some degree, and yet we give millions and billions of dollars in aid all around the world? Where does it come from? I don't know. I wish I could pay my bills that way. You know, I don't have any money, but here's $1 million. So the point I'm making, though, is that the whole world is blessed by the generosity of the West and the Western nations and the descendants of Abraham. But even more so, the whole world will be blessed spiritually through the sacrifice and the life of Jesus Christ. But we understand here's a promise from God to Abraham, and it was a promise based upon, to some degree, whether or not Abraham would obey God. Would he follow through on what God asked him to do, to leave his land, to leave his father's house, go to a new land, it says, where God would show him, and then follow through on the obedience to God. So we know Abraham left Ur. Genesis 13. Here's the situation where Abraham and Lot are dividing the land, and we know that Abraham, wanting to keep peace in the family, you know, what wisdom he demonstrated. He let Lot choose first. And what did Lot do? Lot looked and said, wow, right down there in this valley of Jordan, there's a river, there's these beautiful plains, all this beautiful area, I'm taking it. And you're giving me first choice, I'm going to take it. It's like if you slice a pie or a cake and there's a bigger piece and you let children choose first. I've never seen one take the smaller piece. Whoever chooses first takes the bigger piece. And that's what Lot was doing here. So he's taking the Jordan Valley and the Jordan River. But we read in verse 14 where it says, "And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift up your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give to you and to your descendants forever." So he makes this very clear that what he's saying. He says, "I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered." So here we see that his descendants would be like the dust of the earth. So if any of you have ever dusted in your house, you know that there's a lot of, how do you count it? And it might be referring to dirt. So if you've ever gotten some mud on your shoes or your boots, whatever it might be, how do you count it? The point, of course, is that it's innumerable. You can't just sit down and count it and say, I have 52 dust bunnies. So he must be talking about 52 descendants. It's innumerable. So we see dust here, but as we go through these promises, we'll see also what else does he tell him to say. If you could count these, you'd be able to count your descendants. Well, he tells him the stars. Look at the stars. Look at the sands of the seas. So here's the promise. Again, this is a promise made to Abraham that God is going to bless him and his descendants, and that the number of his descendants will not be able to be numbered. So he says, "Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you." So we understand this was part of the land that God finally gave the nation of Israel when they were brought out of Egypt. Genesis chapter 15. We'll go to the third time that this is mentioned. So we've been through two sections of scriptures where promises were made to Abraham that his descendants would be great in number. And we also recognize that they will be blessed. We understand that some of the blessings that are mentioned, as far as the physical blessings, they were conditional. If you look at the physical blessings that God promised to Israel, there were conditions on them. If you go through what we call the blessings and cursings chapter, it says, if you do this, I'll do this. But the promises that are eventually made to Abraham, they are unconditional. Even though human beings can circumvent them or cause them to be delayed based upon their actions, we can think of one really good example. God wanted to give the nation of Israel a promised land, a land of milk and honey. And we know the 12 tribes or 12 spies went into this land, and they brought back reports, and 10 of them said, there is no way we could take over this land. So what happened? They had to wander for 40 years. So God was willing to give them that promised land, but they circumvented it, they postponed it. So the point that I'm making by bringing that out is that we see that at various times human beings can postpone God's blessings or circumvent God from giving blessings. But these are promises. Now we're going to read that it's God turns it into a covenant with Abraham. And a covenant is a very formal agreement that he makes. So in Genesis chapter 15, verse 5, he says, "Then he brought him outside and said, 'Look now toward heaven and count the stars, if you are able to number them.' And he said to him, 'So shall your descendants be.' And he believed in the Lord, and God accounted it." When it says he, it means God. God accounted it to him for righteousness. And so this is where he tells him to step outside. If you could count the stars, you'd be able to understand how many descendants you're going to have, how blessed you and your family will be. Verse 18, "On the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates.'" And he goes through here all the peoples that are there. But he's telling Abram that "to your descendants I have given this land." And he gives these boundaries. And at that time, if you read history at various times, it'll say something along the lines that so-and-so conquered all of the known world. Well, I'm not saying this is all of the known world, but this is where the vast majority of people were at that time. This is where people had settled after the flood. So this was that area between the river of Egypt, which of course is the Nile, all the way to the river Euphrates. So this very large area, the center of the world, I guess, the center of the known world as it was at that time, is what we're reading about. So now it went from being a promise to being a covenant. And let's turn to chapter 17, Genesis chapter 17. Verse 1, "When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, 'I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you, and will multiply you exceedingly.' Then Abram fell on his face and talked with him, saying, 'As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham.'" And that's, of course, how we refer to him today. "The father of the faithful is Abraham. 'For I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you and their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and your descendants after you." And then it goes through as far as the land that he's going to give to him. But the point that I wanted to make out again, he's making these promises about his descendants and them being fruitful and them being kings coming from his descendants. And now it's an everlasting covenant. So the God who cannot lie made these promises and made this covenant, which was now it's listed as an everlasting covenant with Abraham. Chapter 18. So we're still just going through the various times in Genesis where these promises, this covenant is ratified and being made. And the reason I wanted to do this is because anytime the Bible repeats something over and over, it shows importance. And it shows the importance of these promises that God made to Abraham. So the book of Genesis, we know and understand, is a book of origins. And so we see the origins of the promises to Abraham. We see the origins of God working with people in this way. And eventually it leads to the origins of the nation of Israel. And so he, Genesis 18, we'll just read a couple of verses. Verse 16 says, "Then the men rose from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on the way. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing?" So this is chapter 18. Now we're in verse 18. "Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him." So we understand that this is God. There's some significance here as to who Abraham is speaking with. So Abraham had a very personal relationship with God. It does show the tetragrammaton in verse 17. So you probably have heard that term before, where it's whenever it's Lord in all caps, L-O-R-D, as it is in verse 17, it's referring to Yahweh. So Yahweh was face to face with Abraham and talking to him, making the point that he has made this covenant with him. So the point is that this was the Word. This was God. So God came down, sat with Abraham, and had this conversation with them. And he's making it very clear, "Since Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him." And so that covenant is reiterated here in chapter 18. The sixth time that it's mentioned is in chapter 21, after Isaac is born. Verse 1. Where it says, "And the Lord visited Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him." So we see that there was a set time that this was going to come about, as far as according to God's plan. Now, as human beings, we certainly understand that we prefer things to be done in our time. God says he had a set time for this, and even though they tried to work it out in their own means that we understand through human reasoning, it happened at the set time of which God had spoken. "And Abraham called the name of his son," this is verse 3, "he called the name of his son who was born to him, who Sarah bore to him, Isaac." And we know that he circumcised him on the eighth day, and that this was passed on, this promise was through Isaac. So the primary blessings are via Abraham and Sarah, and the promises go through Isaac. So part of understanding about the promises that were given to Abraham and to his descendants certainly allow us to understand some of the problems that are going on in the world today. As far as there's Ishmael through Hagar, but God's promises to Abraham and to his descendants were through Abraham and Sarah and through Isaac. So what we find is that there's this constant conflict going on between these various peoples. So we understand the last example is when Abraham's faith, as it says, is confirmed, when he is going to sacrifice Isaac. So if you look in chapter 22, we see that Abraham was willing to go above and beyond what any other human being had done, or in God working with human beings, anyone else up to that point. And so he was willing. So there's throughout time, the years, you may have heard sermons on this, whether God ever expected Abraham to actually sacrifice Isaac? We certainly don't think so. God wasn't a proponent of child sacrifice. We know that it was a part of worship, and even Israel went into child sacrifice as a form of worship. But God never asked or commanded that his people worship him in that way. But the intent was to know whether or not Abraham was willing to sacrifice Isaac, and we know that he was willing. So God says that he, in John 3:16, we know the verse. How many of you know that verse without looking at it? John 3:16. Yeah, that's one that we understand. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. What we find is that Abraham had a heart as God. Abraham was willing to give his son, Isaac, or sacrifice him if that's what God asked for. Abraham certainly understood God had the power to resurrect him if he did want him to do that. But he was willing to do it. So the implications here, of course, go into the fact that God the Father was willing to give his only begotten son. And Abraham, who was willing to sacrifice, if that is what God was going to ask him to do, he was willing to sacrifice his son. So we see the implications there. And then we come down to verse 17, where it says, "In blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So we understand that at this point, God says, now I know you. You'll do whatever I ask. You are obedient. These things will happen. So no matter what Israel does to prevent me from giving them the promised land, no matter what they do as they go through their lives and separate into various nations and get captive by the Assyrians and the Babylonians, God promises, God who cannot lie, promises to fulfill these blessings to and through Abraham. So we see the spiritual blessing again of Jesus Christ coming through his descendants in the physical blessings of the national blessings that were unconditional. They were going to happen. So we understand these promises were made to Abraham concerning his family. And then we know that these physical blessings were passed on. So let's look at how they were passed on in Genesis 25, verse 11. It simply says that it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt at Beer Lahairol. So we see and we understand that the physical blessings were passed on from Abraham. And again, God intended it to be with Abraham and Sarah. So the blessings came from Abraham through his son Isaac. So it was passed on to Isaac. And then if you turn to Genesis 27, Genesis 27, verse 27. You'll recognize this chapter as when Rebekah and Jacob deceived Isaac into blessing Jacob. So Jacob and Esau were twins. And we know that technically, from what we understand, Esau was the firstborn. They seem to have been born in rapid succession. And Esau came out and Jacob grabbed his heel. That's why he was called the supplanter. But technically, Esau was the firstborn. Isaac had determined that. all indications are that Isaac had determined to bless Esau as the firstborn. Now, God didn't determine that. It certainly seems to be God's plan. It's not that Jacob just went about this, and because he did it, it couldn't be reversed. If you read through the scriptures later on, it seems as if Isaac doesn't take it back or anything once he realizes what happened. But again, we see that it wasn't in God's time. Human beings were working it out with human reasoning. But we come to the point where we see that Jacob is blessed. Verse 27, he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing and blessed him and said, "Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field." Don't we all want that to be said about us? He apparently was very proud of this hunter. So, Mrs. Godfrey, when your husband comes back from hunting, do you say, "Ah, you smell good"? That's the way I think of you. But obviously, that's how Isaac thought of Esau. And we understand that he was his favorite son. But he says that it's like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore, may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you. So we understand that Jacob receives this blessing. So this, the promises of these physical blessings and spiritual blessings are passed from Abraham to Isaac and then to Jacob. And we understand that from Jacob, it goes down to the sons of Joseph. So let's go to chapter 48, Genesis 48. Hopefully I got that sped out before you turn to Exodus, but we're in Genesis still, Genesis 48. Again, we could read a lot of these verses to make these points. I want to read verses 5 and 6, where we come down. We went from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob and the two sons of Joseph. In verse 5, it says, "Now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Your offspring, whom you beget after them, shall be yours, and will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. But as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan on the way, and there was but a little distance to go to Ephrah, and I buried her there on the way to there." Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, "Who are these?" So the point I want to make is in verse 5, where it says, "And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, they are mine. Just like Reuben, just like Simeon, just like any of my sons, they are mine." So we see that the two sons here are blessed. Verse 14 of the same chapter. "Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly. For Manasseh was the firstborn." So again, this wasn't an accident. This is what was meant to be done. Verse 15, "And he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be upon them." So understand this. "Let my name be upon them." That has ramifications, especially in the end time. When we talk about the time of Jacob's trouble, I've been asked before, is why does that apply mainly? When we talk about the time of Jacob's trouble, we talk about the fall of Great Britain and America, the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. Well, Jacob, Israel, at this point, he put his name on them. So it indicates many things, but that's one of the things. "So let my name be named upon them in the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." Now, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, because he knew that that Manasseh was the firstborn. It displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." And so he blessed them that day, saying, "By you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh." And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. So the point of going through these verses that we just covered is to show that the promises were made to Abraham and to his descendants, and the promises continued from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then to Ephraim and Manasseh. So we understand to whom the promises were made. We understand how the promises were made. And then we come to Genesis chapter 49. So we know from, if you read through this, you'll recognize these verses in 49. Verse 1, it says, "And Jacob called his sons and said, gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." Now that's an important statement in the context of what we're talking about, and in the context of who Jacob is speaking to. So Jacob is speaking to his sons, and he's speaking to Ephraim and Manasseh, so the descendants of Israel, as we understand, the 12 tribes, 13 with Ephraim and Manasseh. But he says, "In the last days, I'll tell you what shall befall you in the last days." And commentaries and theologians try to make these last days go away. But if you understand the term last days, it is referring to the time shortly before Jesus Christ returns to the earth. And the significance of that is that we believe and teach from Scripture that the 12 tribes are still there before Jesus Christ returns. And so they are scattered throughout the world, but we do believe that the 12 tribes are still there. So all 12 still exist in the last days, just before the return of Jesus Christ. So some people will try to say that there's only the nation of the Jews, and I can't pretend to understand it enough to know why the Jews think there aren't the other tribes. You know, the Jews, in their minds, I can only speak from my understanding, but they believe they are the chosen people. They believe that that land is their land. It's not Reuben's or Ephraim's or anyone else's. It's theirs. It's the Jews' land. So when it says, "I give this to you and your descendants forever," the Jew says, "We are the descendants of Abraham, and this land is ours." And so they claim to be the chosen of God, the people of God, and that all these blessings were given to them, and that land God gave to them. And why do you think they stand and fight for it? That is because God has given it to them. So some people will say that the other tribes never existed, whether it's myth or just bad theology, or whatever, legends, whatever it might be. There's only the Jews. Others will say that all the other tribes mixed in with the Jews, Judah, and so that's why there's only the Jews today. They're just all kind of blended together. But this says that they're going to be told what's going to be happening to them in the last days. And the term literally means that time shortly before Christ returns. Now, does it mean the last 3.5 years or the last 100 years? We don't know exactly, but shortly before Christ returns, sometime in there, it's referring to the last days. And these prophecies are given about the various tribes, so that all the tribes will be there in the last days before Christ returns. And just a couple of things to point out. Verse 2, "Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father." And so it goes through the various ones. Probably in Clarksville, I'll read verse 3 about Reuben, since we believe it's France and Letitia should be there. I always pick on her on the stuff relating to France. But So they come together and they hear the prophecies. And if we drop down to verse 10, it says, the scepter, I wanted to make this point. We can read about the physical blessings, but we certainly read about the spiritual blessings. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people. So we certainly understand that the line of David, his father Jesse, was from the line of Judah. And if we go through the line of Jesse and David, we come to the line of Jesus Christ. We recognize that Christ came from the line of Judah. And the scepter shall not depart. And so we could go through the prophecies and the understanding that we have about there shall always be a king on the throne of David. And you're probably aware and have heard in the past about the even today, the coronation chair in which the kings are or queens are put into their place in their office. There's that stone there. Legend has, now this is legend, we can't prove this from scripture, and I'm one of those people that's very skeptical about any of these things. If you've ever traveled, I've never been to Jerusalem, but from what I understand, you can buy pieces of the cross. So how many millions of people have bought a piece of the cross? And they say it's a miracle. There's more pieces we can sell tomorrow. We sold out today, but there'll be more tomorrow somehow. And traveling in Asia, I've been to several places where there's teeth of Buddha. And I finally asked somebody, how can there be so many teeth? How could Buddha have so many teeth? And somebody finally said, well, he's been reincarnated a number of times. So it's teeth from various reincarnations of Buddha. But point I'm making is I'm skeptical about these kind of things myself. But legend is that's the same stone that Jacob rested his head on when he had visions of the ladder and the angels coming up and down from heaven. But this stone, of course, is the coordination under the coordination chair, so that when any of the kings or queens of England are put into their position, it's based on that. So we read that this scepter shall not depart from Judah. So we certainly can understand or should be able to see that there were great and wonderful promises that were given to Abraham and to his descendants. And when we look at it today, the nation of that has descended into Great Britain, he was told that it would be a company of nations. I should have kept my notes. For some reason, one of those things that constantly gets mixed up in my mind is Ephraim and Manasseh. So when I talk about Great Britain, you know which one I'm talking about. It says that he would be the company of nations, many nations. And then when you get to the other one, it says that he will be a great nation. So throughout history, how many brothers have become a company of nations and a great nation? The point I want to make by this is that we see the fulfillment of God's promises in the last 400 years. So they've been types of them. King Solomon in Israel was a type of this wonderful blessings and prosperity, type of even the millennium. But what we're talking about as far as the physical blessings for the nations through Abraham, his descendants, we've seen it be fulfilled even in our lifetime. So the last 400 years, Britain and their company of nations, Great Britain, and of course America, the United States, being a great nation from which all the world is blessed in that physical sense. So these wonderful physical blessings. So I do have a couple of things that I'll leave if any of you would like copies of these. This was right off of Life, Hope, and Truth website. And what it is, it's Abraham's descendants. It doesn't tell you exactly where they are. This just goes through Abraham and his descendants, and it talks some about what I talked about today, just in a very short caption here. And then also, this is the chart that is used at Foundation Institute. Mr. Franks uses it in one of his classes. And this chart is on the possible location of the tribes of Israel. So we don't know 100% with no doubt exactly where all of them are, and some of them will even say scattered. And that's a very safe way to put it. They're scattered. But some of them we think we know. For example, Reuben we believe to be the nation of France. So with all of that said, brethren, we can't choose where we are born, but we can give thanks. And we could be grateful to God for the wonderful blessings that He has bestowed upon Abraham's descendants.